Wonderful photograph. So let's give Tristan a big round of applause. That was amazing. Having tried to shoot before out of a plane, I know it's no easy task, especially with a Hasselblad. So kudos to you. So my bigger question, though, was how do you keep going with taking such powerful images and seeing some of the environmental impacts that you've seen? So what is it that just keeps you motivated to keep shooting and telling the story?
It's definitely not for the money, because that's not a reality. I think what keeps me going, a lot of it is like honoring my father's legacy. You know, I think that he was such a model of rebellion, of taking, examining an issue, examining like intersections between culture and policies. And he was a ceramic sculptor, for those of you, just to give you a little background. He was a ceramic sculptor who did very realistic sculptures of everyday objects that were tethered to the working class or were statements on like a material culture, and became, I guess what would be the best word, they became, he was making larger statements about our value systems. And I think that something like that, I knew that I could never fill his shoes in the context of ceramics or sculpture. But I wanted to, I want to continue, my whole worldview is basically just his. And I don't think, there are a lot of people that are angry at their parents. I am definitely not one of those people. And I'm really proud of all the work that he did and the impact that he had, and the conversations that he started with his work. The idea of material culture, the idea of throwing something away as opposed to fixing it or repairing it. A lot of his work had to do with that. The idea of mass consumerism, overconsumption. All these things come into play. So on one level, I'm just genuinely interested in it, and I like thinking about why we do what we do and what forces inform that, both structural and cultural, from settlement patterns to private property rights to motivation like profit motivations and whatnot. On a personal level, it's totally to try and do my best to not embarrass my old man.
I'm just curious. You've shot for the New York Times, Mother Jones, Audubon, Bloomberg, Wall Street Journal. Is there a photo you will not take?
Well, I managed to strip like all like sexuality. Can I say that on the radio? I managed to strip all sexuality out of my work. Not necessarily intentionally, but I'm just like. So I. When there have been some accusations flying around about photographers being scoundrels on the sets, I was the least worried. you know, going back to the Aurora Theater shooting in Colorado, that's the last time I'll do that. I think it's not that I don't think that those photographs are necessary, but I don't think that 40 of us standing shoulder to shoulder, all shooting the same picture, is necessary. I think that coordination and empathy and the marriage between who you are and what you do is really important. So if there's a major news event and I have to go cover it, I really try to walk... I try to walk softly. I try to treat people as I'd like to be treated. I try to be very respectful. And it's never been an impediment to achieving any kind of closeness with folks. And I think people can pick up on that. So, I guess that. I would be a terrible advertising photographer because I have no idea how to recognize I can only sort of recognize something that's interesting. but never flattering. And so, but that's not really what you're asking, so.
I'd like to follow up really on both of those questions. So I've seen you now give versions of this presentation three times today. And they are, like, without exception, visually wonderful and interesting. And I'm trying to figure out what emotional energy is behind them, knowing very well the content about what you're trying to talk about, because I write about the same stuff, and my response tends to be full of a kind of a burning anger and grief over, I mean, the things, in case those of you in the audience are not hip to this, there's a fairly serious environmental catastrophe going on right below the surface, actually, literally, of these photographs. But the energy here is really of aesthetic beauty. And I wonder if you could just talk about how, I mean, I'm not a photographer, I'm a writer, and I'd like to hear you talk about the way that beauty and trauma, or whatever you want to call, intersect, and how you make those choices and put whatever you call your emotional content into these images, knowing what you know about what lies behind them.
That's a good question. So I think when it comes to aestheticizing a very serious issue, I try to do it with intention. So keep in mind this frame of eastern Wyoming, and this is like basically the building blocks for the Ogallala. Well, first of all, the doing aerials is kind of an easy way to get people interested in an issue. It's highly visual. And I think that when you want to have these larger discussions, it's important to get people to look at it. So if you keep that in mind, and then if you look at this, here, 1 second. So this is a story I shot for the New York Times on the National Wildlife Repository, which is it's a warehouse outside of Denver, Colorado, packed with illegal animal parts and contraband, all seized at major ports of entry around the United States. All these objects are sort of inherently horrifying. I needed to figure out a way to photograph them to where it was aestheticized just enough to engage people, not over-horrify people, acknowledge the evidentiary qualities of these objects, and there's just a lot going on, right? And so I'd seen some work done out there before that was highly visual. I mean, it looked like a nightmare more than it was. But you have to show restraint, I believe, and finding that right balance. I always make, and this will be the third time you've heard this today, I always make the analogy to cooking. Just because you have all the spices in your cupboard does not mean you need to throw them all in to the soup. And so with something like this, I tried to think critically about what would be the best way to get the most people to look at this without either celebrating them or without turning people off and letting the objects speak for themselves. So with most of my work, if something interesting is happening, it's not rocket science. Like, I've been doing this for 15 years, almost 15, I guess, and there's a certain, you react, the light is nice, there's a moment, you've got your composition down, you're just there, and you know, at a certain point, like, even pushing the button on your camera long enough that you understand it. Doing work like this, to me, is the most difficult part, because everything has to be intentional, and you have to vary the subject matter between things that are exotic and things that are fairly normal. So something like this, where, you know, an elephant had its leg cut off and turned into a footstool, the economy of that versus the economy of, say, like, just what's the difference between this and a deer head, aside from the, you know, a deer mount, the rarity of it. To me, that's I don't have any answers. I'm not a vegetarian. I eat a ton of meat. I've eaten burgers from the Ogallala, but I also am. I also. But I also. I think there's a certain amount of we can be a barbaric species. One of the books that McKay made me read when I was a college student was Barry Lopez's Arctic Dreams. I don't know if any of you are familiar with that book, but I highly recommend it. And there's I think one of the quotes from the book that I lean on almost with every project I do now is I'm gonna butcher the quote, but it has to do with him talking to an Inuit hunter north of the Arctic Circle, and he says that they looked at white people with a combination of like awe and incredulity, whereas they see themselves as a part of the natural world, and they see us as people that can create massive changes to the landscape and the natural world, and because of our technology, we've managed to distance ourselves, perhaps to a detrimental point. And so their word for us, translated, is the people who change nature. And I'm finding that almost every project I do, whether it's for the Times, whether it's on the Ogallala, whether it's fracking in Pennsylvania, or whether it's working for Audubon, I'm seeing the same theme over and over and over and over again. And I don't have any answers, but I do think that I'm trying to arm myself with the tools to ask the questions and at least acknowledge. Yes, go ahead.
So I'm actually also a Berkeley alum, so go Bears.
Yeah.
Sorry. I guess my question for you is, so you went from doing, like, you got your bachelor's in English, right, and then you got your journalism degree, and then after Berkeley you were like, well, I saw that you were like a busboy and you were shucking oysters and all that. And I guess my question to you is, like, how did you find direction in your life to, like, lead you in the path that you chose, right? Because it seems like you had a lot of various interests. Maybe they all intersected somehow, but it's like, for me as like a young person in this economy and like with interest in art, but just the real picture being like, hey, I need money. Like, how did you make that transition, and what were like, I guess, the pros and cons of like maybe pursuing what you're passionate about versus staying in like a secure and stable job that's going to give you that, you know, but basically security?
I am privileged. How about that? You know, I had parents that loved me and supported me. My father taught here, so I was able to go to school here. And so I think that's a huge part of it. I've been thinking a lot about this lately, about all the legs up and opportunities I've had, and like trying not to mess that up. And, like, we weren't wealthy per se, you know, and like I had a lot of chores and I worked a lot. But I think that there's something to be said about having the freedom to find yourself that like I don't think a lot of people have. And so that's a huge part of it. Another part, and what that allowed me to do was basically follow my intuition. I've made a ton of decisions that weren't necessarily resume builders, but I just felt like the right thing to do. When I met my wife, and my future wife, and my present wife, my only wife, I think, in Florida, she was going to Washington, D.C., and I had a really cushy staff job at a newspaper. And I was like, I'm in love, I'm out of here, you know? And I went to D.C. and I fell on my face, and, you know, I had like one assignment in 2 years and I messed that up. It was awful, it was embarrassing. And I only got the assignment because I had a friend who was an editor, you know, so I embarrassed him. But over the years, I've always had a place to come back to and recharge, and that was here. You know, my father owned a property up on West Chestnut Hill Road, like I said, and I could come back, you know, I had mentors I could talk with. I had support, and that's so important. You know, I think that there's institutional support in some other places, you know, where you feel free to do these things, and society supports that, but not necessarily to the same extent here. And so a lot of it has to come down to family. I always tried to work the entire time. So even if, you know, I would go, you know, months without an assignment. So I'd pick up a job landscaping or working construction or shucking oysters, which is the worst job. Like, don't get me wrong, I love oysters, but good God, you know. And I quit when I stabbed myself in the thumb, like, very, like, right, you know, I'm like, I'm out of here, you know. But it's been one of those kind of winding paths that that I feel very fortunate, you know. And as I've become an adult and figured out through, you know, through family, through friends, through being obsessed with the craft and with, you know, just a great set of mentors, and become independent, having, being able to go back and forth with my wife to lean on each other from time to time. When I first moved to DC, I didn't make any money, you know, for a long time, and she made the money. We moved back to Florida, and it came back to me, and then I was working regularly back at the newspaper. You know, we moved to Colorado, and it was half and half. And she ended up with a job at Summit County, and then recently it's been me, but we're a unit, and she just finished nursing school, which is about the most stable sector of the economy. And so that's a huge part of it. I have friends and colleagues where they're both working photojournalists, and they, I mean, it's so challenging. You know, they're competing for the same assignments. And so we take turns going back and forth with financial responsibilities. And so I've never wanted to have a great distinction between personal life and professional life. I've always wanted to move in the direction that I'm, now that I've moved. But I can't take credit for it. I did the best I could with what I had, though. Yeah.
I'm curious about the economics of this project.
Yeah.
You've been showing us. Did you have a grant to go out and do all these photographs? Did you have an advance from a book publisher? Are you just living off your wife for now, or how did it?
She just graduated like 3 weeks ago. No, I'm not living off her yet, but I will. No. Something like this is commissioned by the New York Times.
I meant the what you showed us, all those geology and land management.
I had money saved, and I was also going back and forth quite a bit to that part of the country, because we had left in recent years. So I was able to lean on that, and then use the money from my commissions in order to fund it. I tried to get interest in it, but like I said, tell an editor about a project on land management and watch their eyes glaze over.
No, Tristan, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.